Welcome to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes. You're listening to Alternative Talk AM 1150. And we're here with another featured presenter for the Sparks Conference that's coming up this month now. It's June. Happy June, everybody. Happy June, Eric.
Happy June, Julie.
What a great month to take your dog for a walk.
Why, that's a good point. You would probably want to take some breaks.
Yes.
In between.
That's right.
During the month. But yeah, it's a great month for dog walking.
So SPARKS, the Society for the Promotion of Applied Research in Canine Science, S-P-A-R-C-S. And this year, it is the third annual conference, and it's going to be held this year in Phoenix, Arizona. And it's going to be June 19th through June 21st over that weekend. And if you would like more information, you can go to sparksinitiative.org. And that's Sparks, S-P-A-R-C-S, initiative.org. And it's, you know, leading scientists and researchers in specifically around canine science and a lot of research done in canine cognition, how dogs learn, working with dogs and using this information that scientists are learning through their research and applying it to, you know, tactics, methods, and understanding and working with dogs. So, so today we're talking with Dr. Simon Gadbois, who is on the phone with us from Nova Scotia, Canada. Dr. Gadbois, welcome to The Dog Show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you are speaking all 3 days at the Sparks Conference, and you have a range of really interesting topics that you'll be speaking about. You developed the Canid Behavior Research Team, and that's out of the... Is that part of the university? And how do you pronounce that? Dalhousie University in Canada?
It's Dalhousie.
Dalhousie,
yeah,
okay.
Dalhousie University.
Great.
Yeah, it's basically a lab. We avoid using the word lab simply because there's negative connotations with this, but it's
yeah.
It's just a location, two rooms actually in the department where we do a lot of our research with dogs, and all the dogs we work with, just to be clear, are pets.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not actually keeping dogs at the university. They're volunteered by the owners, and usually they are very work-oriented breeds and individuals.
Yeah. Mm. Now, there's a video that I found of just a clip, about a minute and a half, of some of your program dogs, you know, work being trained in scent detection, and it just looked like they were having a blast. What a great...
Oh, they do, absolutely. And that's an essential condition for us to
yeah.
do this work. I mean, if the dog is not enjoying himself or self, we will immediately tell the owners and everybody moves on. No, they have to have fun, and they have to enjoy work. And probably for that reason, we have a lot of border collies.
Yeah.
they tend to be dogs that enjoy working, and, you know, we'll keep going and going and going. And we use positive methods to train, obviously, mm-hmm. just because it works better and it's the best way to keep everybody happy, dog handlers, trainers, and dogs, obviously.
Yes, and you are, I just want to tell everybody what your talks are going to be about, and then we can get into some other topics of your work. I have a lot of questions about the work that you've done a lot around scent detection and olfaction in dogs, and really curious about your perspective on their sense of smell. So the first day, so the Sparks Conference is June 20th, 21st, and 22nd, and there's speakers lined up all day each day. And
right.
you'll be talking on the first day, you said, on the correlation between stress hormones and aggression.
Yeah, well, one of my talks is on aggression, and it's based actually quite heavily on research I did in the 90s with wolves. And at the time, we were trying to understand the role of social stress in reproductive suppression in wolves. Now, that sounds complicated, but just to summarize very quickly, wolves are monogamous.
Mm.
Although they form a family unit, there's only one mating pair, at least in principle. There's some exceptions to this. And biologists have always asked the question, well, what is actually stopping the other wolves from breeding? And one of the theories was that, well, they are too stressed to breed simply because of the aggression, dominance, and dominance hierarchy that's in place in the pack. Although some of that is true, it's not enough, we realize, to explain why the subordinate wolves are not breeding. In fact, it's not because of stress per se, as much as just the fact that they figure it out among themselves in the politics of the pack. So the dominant female will tend to stop the others from approaching the males, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a behavioral mechanism, as far as we can tell, not a physiological one like you would see in some primates, for instance. So
yeah.
That's one of the talks. And I'll talk about aggression in very general terms. I believe that Dr. Kuppinger will do the same as well. But it's to try to put aggression in perspective and in context. And mm-hmm. by this, I simply mean that, unfortunately, too many times we talk about aggression as if it was something very static.
Right.
When it's actually happening in real time, and that means you need to know everything about what just happened,
right?
And what may happen next, and you know, it's not a still picture, in other words.
Yeah, and also the association that people have generally that aggression is always bad, but really, in dogs, it's part of natural, healthy communication, just in how they set boundaries and communicate, you know, get off me or don't take that or whatever. So it's not always problematic either.
No, it's not. And I think, you know, even the whole dominance debate has gone way too far the other way in terms of, you know, some people now even claim, although not scientists, but that it doesn't exist and everything. I think we're going a little bit crazy on this idea. And I think we forget one thing, is that the whole thing about aggression, no more, no less than in humans, for instance, I think dominance also is there for a reason. It's there to avoid actually aggression, contrary to what some people seem to think. It's there to enforce rules, and rules are mostly enforced, and when they're not, wolves and dogs will actually often use mostly ritualized aggression. In other words,
right. They
don't actually fight.
Right.
The whole point is to avoid injury, death, and all these things. But somehow I think we lost perspective on this debate, and now we seem to think that aggression and punishment, that's another word that got very bad negative connotations over the years, and for good reasons. You know, I mean, all of this comes from the 80s and before, when we were very much into harsh methods, coercive methods to train our dogs. You know, so there's a pendulum movement here going on in both science and outside of science on these issues. I think, like in many things in science, the truth is somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we have to let the pendulum movement do its thing and going from one extreme to the other and figure it out somewhere, somehow.
Yeah, I was talking recently with a woman who's been training for about 45 years, and I was talking to her specifically about this this topic. And she said that it really wasn't that the training methods for pet dogs, from her perspective, really weren't the generalized, overly harsh methods. She thinks that the sort of propaganda that any assertive behavior or quote-unquote aggressive behavior is therefore abusive is actually in place to promote the training methods that don't believe you should ever, ever acknowledge a negative behavior or an undesirable behavior, that it was more of a marketing thing than actual. And I don't know. I wasn't there training in the, you know, and so, but I was really interested that that was kind of her perspective on it, because that's what I believed as well, but that's just because of what I heard, not because I was there.
Yeah, no, and it's quite possible, but you see, there's also another thing here, is that I tend to try to get trainers to realize that this is not necessarily a scientific debate. In fact, you could make it a scientific debate if you want, and a lot of people are trying to do this, but I think it's besides the point. I think what you want to see is make it an ethical debate. It's the ethics of it that's important here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And who cares about the science, in a way? It's really about what kind of relationship do you want with your dog.
Yeah.
You want a positive one or a negative one?
Right.
I personally want a positive relationship. I think it's easier to build up on that.
Sure.
Now, at the same time, it does not mean that, you're not allowed to tell your dog sometimes, oops, that's not what I wanted, or maybe you shouldn't do that.
Right.
And And that's the problem now, is that we have people that claim that R plus only is the only way to go. Actually, a lot of the people that say that really are not actually applying that principle. They use punishment, quote-unquote punishment, a lot more than they think.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you think about the definition of punishment, all it means is that you're reducing the frequency or duration or intensity of a behavior. Well, just by saying no, just like that, to a dog, technically that's punishment if it is indeed reducing the frequency or duration,
right,
et cetera, of that behavior.
Yeah.
And I take a cognitive perspective on this, because in modern cognitive psychology and neuroscience, we believe in a concept of information, which is the idea that you actually learn faster if you know what to do and if you know what not to do.
Right.
But you don't have to be harsh about it.
Right.
You can give that information by saying, no, not what I wanted. And you can learn a lot faster if you know, oh, okay, well, all right, fine. I will eliminate that behavior from my repertoire now and move on to something else, right?
Yeah.
But it's an interesting debate, and I think it's one that was needed culturally in a way. And I found this idea interesting that maybe, yeah, maybe it's part of a marketing kind of thing. It wouldn't surprise me in a way. And unfortunately, a lot of people that do this put the scientists as being the ones saying this, you know, that punishment doesn't work. Well, actually, unfortunately, there's a very long, massive literature suggesting it does.
Mm-hmm.
Again, for the wrong reasons, and you don't want to go there because,
right,
giving shocks will stop,
right,
some behaviors.
Right.
Who wants to do that?
Right.
Although, as I say that, some people are still using shock collars and all that. So,
yeah, and it goes back to defining, I think, having a clear understanding of what, quote-unquote, I mean, the word punishment has such a, you know, people kind of freak out,
yeah,
when they hear it. But it really is, like you said, the concept of information, learning faster if you know both what to do and what not to do. But it doesn't mean that your understanding of what not to do has to be involved in some sort of traumatic experience or abusive experience or overly harsh experience. It's just nature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you can think of numerous examples of applying only R plus for a long period of time can be a lot more stressful,
mm-hmm,
than if you were just telling the dog right away,
yeah,
you know what, that's not really what I want you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And solving that problem in 30 seconds or a minute instead of you know, dragging into the only reinforcing the right stuff for, you know, an hour or a day or, you know, sometimes more.
Right.
But, you know, I think the problem is actually with the word punishment. It's just that we go completely crazy when we use that word, and I'm trying not to use it anymore because I think it gets people into the wrong mindset right away, and they shut down immediately when they use it.
Yeah.
And actually, I think there's much better words than that to describe,
yeah,
you know, giving positive or negative feedback to an animal without being coercive,
sure,
at all.
Yeah. Well, it's great. I really appreciate your perspective on this because it is such an important topic in the world of you know, dog training and working with behavior. Is this, you know, the industry is in an identity crisis, and there's all these people arguing with each other and disagreeing and do this, no, do this, and all this stuff. And, you know, the average dog owner ends up very confused when they're trying to research on their own. What should I have a puppy, how should I train it? And they're just kind of, their head is spinning.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, there's also TV personalities, as we know, that,
yeah,
have made all of this a lot more difficult to understand, and created a lot of confusion.
Yeah.
So, no, I wouldn't want to be somebody trying to understand any of this at this point.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's great. We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, I want to get into some of your work, especially around scent detection training. You've done all sorts of work around that, really interesting stuff. We're talking with Dr. Simon Gadbois, who is one of the presenters at this year's Sparks Conference, which is the Society for the Promotion of Applied Research in Canine Science. And if you would like more information, you can go to sparksinitiative.org, and that's Sparks, SPARCS, initiative.org. And I also have links to all this information on our website, dogradioshow.com. We'll be back in just a few minutes. The Natural Pet Pantry is Seattle's original source for wholesome dog and cat meals, offering 8 different protein options to accommodate your pet's dietary needs. Made locally using all U.S.-sourced ingredients, their freshly ground stews, raw or cooked, can be purchased from their 2 stores in Burien and Kirkland, most independent pet supply stores, or delivered right to your door. Go to naturalpetpantry.com for more information. I'm Julie Forbes, and my first choice for my pet's food is the Natural Pet Pantry. It's the educated choice.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to the Ananda Institute of Living Yoga, we cover the world of animals. This week, June 7th, it's Shelter Rescue Sanctuary and anything that helps our animal friends Sunday. We'll check on all of our regulars, the birds and the horses, plus we'll get all the details about elephants, bamboo, and chai now in Oklahoma, and hear more about how you can join me on my birthday, June 20th. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Pure Air's powerful formula lets you eliminate pet odors safely. It's strong enough to effectively get rid of smells like urine, plus stronger odors like those that can be caused by illness. Pure Air is safe enough to spray directly onto people, animals, or use in the bath or laundry. Pure Air is perfect for dealing with dire situations, refreshing your dog between baths, or just before company comes. Pure Air is the most effective product you can buy to remove stinky pet odors safely. Find it at stores like Mud Bay, McClendon's, and Natural Pet Pantry, or visit their website, pureair.com. That's pure, A-Y-R-E.com. I'm Julie Forbes, host of The Dog Show. Pure Air is the only odor eliminator you'll find in my home. You'll love it.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes. And we are back talking with Dr. Simon Gadbois, who is one of the featured presenters at the Sparks Conference this year. I'm bringing us back to Dr. Gadbois' research, and I've posted a link to his website on our homepage, which is dogradioshow.com, and there's also a link to a video of some of his program dogs that are being trained in scent detection. It's really fun to watch, and especially fun to watch how much fun they're having, and I think that's an important connection when we're talking about working. Really not just dogs, but I think this certainly applies to people and certainly applies to me, is I do my best work when I'm having fun. I'm the most brilliant when I'm having fun. And I think that that's, fun is a very powerful experience, and certainly not only in a conversation of ethics, but in a conversation of productivity. So I was just really impressed by that. Was just clear throughout that video. There's a link to that video on our website as well, dogradioshow.com. So you're doing this research on wildlife and conservation dogs and really working on training methods and, evaluating the olfactory performance that, the dogs are basically are you researching the training process involved in generating these scent detection dogs? Or are you researching, it sounds like you're also researching this, the olfaction part, so the sense of smell as well as the training process. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We do both the basic or fundamental research and the applied research, basically.
Okay.
Most of our funding comes from applied or from the desire to see dogs working in those new fields of application of scent detection.
Yeah.
But that allows me to get into some of the theoretical stuff. So it's both at the sensory level, trying to understand what we call psychophysics, actually, or olfactory psychophysics, how they process scent in general, but also strategies around learning, including how to make them learn faster and better. And because the problem, unfortunately, with the applied world of sniffer dogs is that there is a huge cost of time and money.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I think it's responsible for a lot of the lack of popularity of that system, like, for instance, for medical diagnosis. We've known now for at least 10 years that dogs do significantly better to detect some types of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you wonder, well, why is it that we don't have yet an infrastructure, clinics, whatever, to get this going, to get those dogs to diagnose prostate cancer, for instance?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is that, well, it's because implementation is a real issue. Not to mention, you know, convincing the FDA, Health Canada, et cetera, these organizations that it's actually valid.
Mm-hmm.
That's one problem.
Mm-hmm.
But the other one is the cost. And we're working on this at Dalhousie as well, trying to figure out ways to make this a little bit more practical, less costly, because I think that's the main obstacle right now. Not to mention, obviously, the fact that convincing people from the medical establishment and engineers that biological systems are potentially better than technology.
Right.
That's a hard sell. That's
yeah.
really, really hard to get this, you know, convince people of that.
Yeah.
So to get back to what you were saying, I mean, dogs are clearly living in a completely different world than ours.
Mm-hmm.
We cannot even start to imagine what it is to live in that world of borders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's probably as amazing as it is for us to live in a world, a very visual world, you know, of colors, etc.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, except that they process it at you know, more molecular level, if you want.
Mm-hmm. So how would you describe, if someone was like, can you describe what your understanding of how dogs experience a sense of smell? And maybe that's by describing what you know about how it works, you know, in a physiological level, or, you know, I know that the neurophysiology or, you know, in that respect, or from a, just a perspective or understanding, but what would you say about that? Because this is an area of expertise for you.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'll say that it, you know, even with humans, olfaction is something that we really do not understand well.
Mm.
Because we're dealing with a stimulus, the odorant or the odor that we can't see. So for us humans, it's almost impossible to even understand how the brain deals with this.
Mm.
And that's a real challenge because, for instance, in my lab, we always wonder how much contamination we have. We know it's there. We don't see it. We don't smell it.
Sure.
But they do.
Yeah.
And that's a real concern. Most of the researchers I know that work in this area tend to focus a lot on the quantitative stuff, what I call also the hardware. You know, how many genes are involved, how many olfactory receptors, how big the nose is. Honestly, I don't connect with that perception of olfaction. And based on the neuroscience of it, I'm much more interested in what I call the software part of it. And what I mean by this is partially how the brain works in terms of the neurochemicals. And I know now that's starting to sound complicated, but it's really not that complicated. And I think we've had success, great success, with border collies, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And that is counterintuitive for a lot of people that seem to think, for instance, that bloodhounds should be the ultimate mm-hmm. scent dog. And there I will actually argue that maybe not. I mean, part of it is the work ethics of mm-hmm. border collies that we really like. They're intense dogs, as you know, often a bit neurotic as well. But that's good, you know, if you can actually focus that intensity
yeah.
on work, it's great. The mm-hmm. software part of olfaction here comes into play when I actually think that what's really interesting about border collies is they're one of those breeds with, you know, Australian Shepherds and Parsons Terriers and Jack Russells, etc., that I call the dopamine breed. These are dogs that are known to have higher levels of dopamine than other breeds. And I think that's the software part in the sense that when that neurochemical is involved in a breed or individual, highly involved, it really facilitates the olfactory work. And one of the reasons is because there's a lot of dopaminergic, as we call it, involvement in the olfactory bulb. That's an essential part of the olfactory system of you and I and dogs and most mammals, actually. And so in other words, it's not just the hardware, you know, the big nose of the bloodhound, but it's also how it works at the pure leather chemical level and some of the neurotransmitters or those chemicals in the brain that are involved. I think that's the key.
Mm.
You know, border collies are not necessarily the dogs that you would picture as your typical scent dog, but I think it may explain the success of the Malinois, for instance, amazing Belgian sheepdog that are actually very very intense as well. Not unlike border collies in some way.
Yeah.
And they're very good at tracking and trailing, and we think that's part of the same correlation.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not the type to emphasize, you know, this many receptors and this many cells are involved. And I think this is interesting data, but it doesn't explain everything about why a dog is good at olfaction and the olfactory work itself, because it's not just processing smell in a vial. It's also the whole behavior of tracking that is important.
Yeah. One of the questions that I had when I was reading about your work with invasive insect detection is, I'm curious, because you were specifically talking about the brown spruce longhorn beetle, both in lab and field conditions, and showing the ability of the dogs to discriminate that particular species from other domestic and local species. And I'm wondering, in these research projects, especially if it's a new field, I mean, like, you've done work with hypoglycemia and, you know, I don't know if that seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, is kind of along the lines of, like, diabetic alert dogs, where they're detecting low blood sugar and, you know, but this is, like, new. Has anybody ever done research around, you know, scent detection with brown spruce longhorn beetles compared to other beetle species? How do you identify what it is that differentiates them from a scent perspective to train the dogs in the first place?
Well, I mean, again, this is a great area where we work on a complete unknown. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, with the hypoglycemia project that my PhD student Catherine Reeve is working on, we're working with chemists to try to eventually, hopefully, isolate what it is that they are really identifying, allowing them to discriminate low and high blood pressure. Sorry, not blood pressure, but blood sugar level.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it's the same thing with the bugs. So with the longhorn beetle, we're actually working with the larvae. We're interested in the dogs detecting the larvae in the tree. And to make things more complicated here in Canada during the winter. We actually do not know, starting the training, if they can really differentiate between the local and the invasive species. So what we do, basically, is we reinforce the detection of the invasive species.
Right.
And not reinforce the detection of the local domestic species.
Right.
And we just hope that after a while they'll get it. That's essentially it.
And if they do, then it really reinforces that question of, like, well, what are they smelling? I mean, is it genetic?
That's right. So we've had actually this spring the confirmation that they can differentiate in the lab.
Mm.
They're doing quite well at detecting and discriminating.
Yeah.
We think it's probably a pheromone. Although there's some questions there, if you actually look at the biology of those insects, how much of a distinct smell would they have at the larval stage? It could be extremely subtle, and I'm not going to pretend that it's easy for the dogs, by the way.
Mm.
They can do it, but some dogs are pretty close to chance.
Mm.
So we know it's a challenge, and we're actually working on techniques right now to try to turn this around, get them a little bit more accurate. Especially in the field. The field has been less than conclusive so far, but in the lab they seem to be having a better handle on it. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, and it's, although we see applications of scent dogs on all kinds of things now, it's not to say that it's always easy and it always works.
Yeah.
You know, every time we get into a new project, we never know what's going to happen. A number of years ago when we started looking for ribbon snakes, which are endangered here in Nova Scotia, we had tons of people telling us this would never work. Mm-hmm. They don't have a distinctive smell enough. They'll find garter snakes instead. Mm-hmm. You're working in a marshy area. It's known to be very difficult for dogs to work in those conditions. Well, to this day, this is by far our most successful program.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started working on wood turtles.
Mm-hmm.
I was absolutely convinced that this would be dead easy for the dogs to do. Mm-hmm. Such a slow animal, a lot of a big fingerprint on the ground, if you want, mm-hmm. and it will be easy to track. Well, actually, it's very inconclusive so far if they actually make a difference compared to just human. Because in this kind of conservation work, what we do is we compare human-only team and human-dog team. And what we want to see is that teams with dogs are doing better at finding more of those endangered species.
Right.
But interestingly, with the wood turtles, it's not clear. I mean, it's marginally better, but not very convincing so far.
So
it's very mysterious. We don't really know why.
Are they detecting other turtles as well? Is that what the problem is? Or are they, are humans just as good as finding the turtles?
It's mostly that we can see that humans are almost as good, but there's a seasonal pattern which we can't really explain.
Mm.
The dogs are still better in the spring, mm-hmm. and we think this may have to do with hormones in the turtles.
Mm.
So basically pheromones, mm-hmm. Very specific smells that are produced by those mm-hmm. animals during the breeding season and the egg-laying season. And then later those odors disappear, so the dogs seem to be unable to identify the or as easily as humans anyway, visually, the turtles.
Yeah.
And we had a similar experience with eggs. We were hoping they could find the nest where those turtles lay their eggs. And what's fascinating is they really are not good at it.
Hmm.
Which, you know, if you think about it, is probably good for the turtles.
Yeah.
If you take a turtle egg and smell it, even
right.
if it was actually isolated from any kind of organic substrate, you know, like in milk carton or whatever,
right.
you would actually notice that by itself it has a very earthy smell. So in this case, it's the amazing biology of turtles that, you know, they use kind of a olfactory camouflage, if you want.
Wow.
So their eggs actually smell like earth. So no wonder that raccoons and
sure.
and skunks and foxes and dogs can find the nest.
Takes camouflage to a whole nother level of conversation.
But no, it does, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you, is there enough data to have this opinion? I'm not sure, but have you found that, like, so dogs in general, so let's say you take, 10 dogs who are great, great scent detection dogs. Do you think that certain individuals, based off of just the fact that they're an individual or breed or who knows what, but would this individual maybe be better at detecting this scent versus that scent, given that they don't seem to be any harder or easier than each other, like just because of individual sensitivity specifically pertaining to their sense of smell? Like, oh, I'm really good at smelling, nuts and peanuts and stuff like that. But,
yeah.
And then this other dog isn't quite so sensitive to that, but might be great at bed bugs or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know that I can actually say anything about that. I don't think I have enough data
mm-hmm.
to comment on this, but it's a good question. In fact, it's often a question that people will ask in the context of, do you train your dogs to smell many different odors or stimuli? And the answer is, it depends on the dog. So maybe that's another way of approaching your question.
Mm-hmm.
We seem to be able to teach some dogs to go after about anything. We just have to tell them what we're looking for and they'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
Other dogs seem to be real specialists.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm good at this and don't bother me with anything else, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unclear to me why this happened.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really say. I think we've had some surprises in the past. I mean, some biological odors, like when I was mentioning the ribbon snakes, for instance,
mm-hmm.
That seem to be easy for most of our dogs to detect. We've had other dogs that are absolutely unable to figure it out.
Huh.
So it especially in terms of discrimination with, for instance, garter snakes.
Mm-hmm.
Although, to be honest with you, I can't tell the difference between the two when I sniff the samples from those snakes. But
yeah.
Yeah, So, yeah, that's a difficult question to answer. I don't really have an answer for that.
Yeah. And then also it kind of brings up, well, is it their actual sense of smell, or is it how they experience the training process, or is it something in their brain, or, you know, like, oh, I'm really good at I can't multitask, but I can focus on one thing, but I can't really switch tracks like that, as opposed to another individual that might be better at kind of multitasking and having.
That's right. And as you know, Sparks will have a full day in Rhode Island on personality.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's clearly a big factor as well. There's no doubt about it. I think some dogs also, it's not just the olfactory work. I think it's the whole attitude toward work in general.
Yeah.
You know, and although we have great success with border collies and probably the highest retention of all breeds in our team, at the same time, they are really sometimes really neurotic dogs. I mean, some of them are just, you know, when we first get them in screening, we go like, oh my, what are we going to do with this dog? But at the same time, it's that same neuroticism that, you know, if you really can turn this around, like, look, you have a job now. This is what you do. This is your thing.
Yeah.
Yay, you're a hero. That's what you do. Yes, you're
right.
Good at it. Fantastic. Then we get dogs that are absolutely fantastic, and they seem to almost find I mean, I know this is a bit dramatic the way I'm going to say it, but almost a reason to live, you know?
Well, it's what they're made to do. They're like, thank God, I finally have something to do. I've been unemployed for 5 years or whatever, you know?
That's right.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And especially since, you know, most of the owners that actually volunteered their dogs to our lab, I have to work during the day, and they'll say my dog is driving me insane, and it's driving himself insane in the process.
Yeah.
Please take him, you know, give him a job, give him something to do. Sometimes we have great surprises there, and but personality, there's no doubt, is important here. In fact, I can tell you that if you look at the dogs that we don't keep, based on our attrition data, so dogs leaving the program, I would say that most of the time it's because of, I'll use the word personality here, but temperament, attitude towards work, more so than their actual ability to sniff.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting piece of information in itself, I think. I think that says a lot about dogs and, you know, the challenges, especially of working with dogs. They're very much like us.
Yes.
They have personalities, what can I say?
I know, yeah. And this is something I talk, my area of expertise here is dog training and behavior, and I do private lessons with people in the Seattle area, and I meet with all different types of dogs, you know, border collies to whippets to chihuahuas to bulldogs, you know, all over the place, mixed breeds. And one of the things about, you know, every person has, you know, different levels of expectation, but depending on my sense for the dog is, you know, and what you said, what is their attitude towards work? Because some dogs are like, oh, we're going to do obedience training? Yes, awesome. Like my cattle dogs just want to be told what to do. What are we doing? What are we doing? And other dogs are like, what is the point of this? Like, can't, you know, I'd rather be, you know, I'm interested in maybe hunting things or, you know, doing other types of work, but they're just really not interested in it. And that is a hard thing to sort of change in a dog. I think you can improve on it, but it's something important for people to be sensitive to and to have a reasonable expectation of the individual, because you wouldn't want, that's what can really cause stress, is if you take a dog that's just, for whatever reason, not interested or comfortable, and you kind of force them to do a type of work that they're really not motivated to do.
Absolutely. And you know, it's probably one of the reasons why one of our most important criterion is the play drive, as we, well, I mean, some people call it that. But, I mean, it's just the, if they see work as play, then they have a good chance to succeed in my lab.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it probably won't work. But that's a little bit what I'll be talking about in the second day at Sparks. It's this whole aspect of the anticipatory system in the brain, this whole idea that some dogs really get turned on, if you want, by anticipation of reward, whatever that means. It could be play, it could be a kibble, it can be a verbal praise, a tap on the head, whatever. And some of the dogs, not so much, you know. And there's breed and individual differences there. And yes, that's really the key to training, especially positive training. If you really want to work with mostly reinforcement, you really need a dog that will respond really well to reward, but actually mostly the anticipation of reward. That's really how the brain works.
Interesting. Well, we have just a few minutes left, and there's one other question that really stuck out to me in another type of, I'm still on the scent detection training, but when you're talking about the hypoglycemia and really specifically with kids in your medical detection and assistance dogs, one of the topics or points was that you were, and intentions was that you were interested in examining the challenges of embedding a trained dog into a family and the psychosocial aspect of the relationship between. And I think child, I think you could do between adult and assistance dog. And then when you say child and assistance dog, it kind of adds a whole nother host of challenges because these dogs are not in, you know, a controlled environment where they're just fully, it's fully about enjoying the work. And then kids can't be trusted to, you know, care for an animal and be able to be sensitive to the needs of the animal if the animal is there to alert to low blood sugar. How far have you gotten in that part of the work? There's the sort of task training of teaching the dog to detect the scent, and then with assistance dogs there's so much more. I mean, if you're getting into, you know, public access and all sorts of stuff. So how far have you gotten with that part of it?
Not very far yet, because we're still struggling with the basics of blood sugar discrimination. The interesting thing there is that we don't really know what it is that they're detecting, and that's really what we're trying to do. And I've been talking to a large number of trainers, many trainers that have actually worked with these dogs, and we all seem to converge now towards this idea that it's not blood sugar levels, really, or things correlated to it that they detect as much as a stress response in the individual. Because some people seem to think that it's a stress response. Essentially, they will detect an upcoming seizure as easily as a hypo or hyperglycemic event. So it's not, that medical condition specifically that they get alerted to.
It's a body's response otherwise.
Yeah, and that complicates things quite a bit for us, because now we're thinking, well, maybe we're looking too deeply into what endocrinological correlate, hormonal correlate they're picking up on.
Yeah.
So we're working with an endocrinologist, Dr. Beth Cummings, and a pediatric health psychologist, Elizabeth McLaughlin, here in Halifax. And, eventually we want to get to the implementation of the dogs in the families, because the whole idea of this was to get into the nocturnal hypoglycemia detection.
Yeah.
This idea that a young kid can die or get into a coma if an hypoglycemic event is not detected at night.
Yeah.
Some kids are too small to have the pump or a continuous blood glucose monitor on them, or there's, social or medical reasons why they can't. Also, that technology may not be as accurate and reliable as people think. This is actually based on a number of scientific papers.
Yeah.
So adding the dog into the equation, we thought, would be a great idea. The problem is we're not there yet. We've been 2 years into looking into just training the dogs to detect blood sugar levels in lab condition with samples from spit, breath, sweat. And it's just recently that we are starting to get an indication that they can do it, but it's not really, it's not easy, and it's a very time-consuming training procedure. And we're not even sure that that's the primary stimulus. Again, we think it may be just a general stress response that they detect.
And would that mean that the dog would have to basically stay up overnight also?
Well, there's evidence actually that they seem to be able to alert, and it's not just dogs, by the way. Cats also have done this, even when they're not in the same room. as the child. Mm. So they can be in principle asleep and still respond to it.
It's amazing.
Yeah, amazing. And honestly, as a scientist, I'm actually very skeptical about all of this.
Yeah.
I want to see it.
Yeah.
But we're not there yet. Now, right now, we're just trying to answer the basic question. What is it that they're really detecting? Because I think that can influence training as well, including speed-up training procedures later on.
Yeah.
Because tons of people are asking about those dogs and what is our training protocol, and keep saying, well, we actually don't know yet.
Yeah.
We don't even know what stimulus to work with.
Right. I have a story for you of a diabetic alert dog. My wife is the vice president of the Assistance Dog Club of Puget Sound, and I've attended and spoken at a few of their meetings, and there is a member who has a diabetic alert dog. It's an old English sheepdog. And the dog alerted. They were at a talk or a conference, I think, with rows of chairs. And the dog alerted to someone who was several rows behind them. I mean, they alerted to someone else who had diabetes and whose blood sugar had fallen low. So it was like, oh, hey, you over there, it's happening to you right now, too. So you might want to check that. So it was just, yeah. So,
yeah, well, yeah. I mean, again, we have, it's so mysterious how they do this. And you know, the other possibility, to go back to the principle of personality, too, it's quite possible that it's not just every dog that can do this. I mean, not that they don't have the ability to do it. They may not even realize they can.
Right.
Or they may not even care.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Some of the early work we did in olfaction was actually with forensic application.
Uh-huh.
And one thing that we discovered is any time that you're asking a dog to detect something that is based on a human odor, there's a problem because they've learned most of their lives to actually ignore the odor of human. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise it would be way too overwhelming. It's all around them.
Yeah.
So to teach a dog to actually now suddenly pay attention to it and in detail, is really, really hard, actually. At first, they don't get it. They don't understand.
Yeah.
So one of the things that my graduate student will talk about at Sparks is how we do what we call saliency training, which is basically training them to respond to very low saliency stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a long, gradual process, but teaching them that basically, stimuli that are barely detectable are actually irrelevant, even if they're human.
Yeah.
And that's a real, real challenge.
Well, I could be here for a few more hours, I think, talking to you, but I've got to let you go now. And it's just been really wonderful to have you on the show, and I look forward to, hearing from a distance your talks at this year's Sparks conference. And this year, it is the third annual conference, and it's going to be held this year in Phoenix, Arizona, and it's going to be June 19th through June 21st over that weekend. And if you would like more information, you can go to sparksinitiative.org, and that's Sparks, SPARCS, initiative.org. And we've been talking with Dr. Simon Gadbois, who is just doing all sorts of interesting research, and I've posted links to all of his research on our homepage, which is dogradioshow.com. So thanks so much for your time today. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a few minutes. You're listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
Wish your dog didn't hate going to the vet? Wish you were welcomed by a team who cared? Jet City Animal Clinic is an enjoyable respite from the same old thing. Dr. Anderson and her team have created a full-service facility that combines veterinary expertise with a comfortable style. Jet City Animal Clinic is located in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood on 12th Avenue across from Seattle U. Bring your crazy questions, odd ideas, and alternative thinking. Jet City Animal Clinic will work with you to keep your furry family members healthy and happy. Traditionally educated with an open mind, call us at 206-329-0253 or email info@jetcityanimalclinic.com to make an appointment. Jet City Animal Clinic, a unique approach to the health care of your urban pet, a local family practice. JetCityAnimalClinic.com.
This is Julie Forbes, dog training, behavior, and nutrition specialist and owner of Sensitive Dog, thoughtful guidance for you and your dog. If your dog needs basic obedience training, a behavior evaluation, or food consultation, I can help you. Call me at 206-372-7399 or visit my website, www.sensitivedog.com. I teach group obedience classes, in-home lessons, and evaluations, and a two-week intensive training program called Higher Education. Again, I'm Julie Forbes, Seattle's dog behavior training and nutrition specialist. www.sensitivedog.com.
Next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Jonathan Shapiro, Emmy and Peabody Award-winning TV writer and producer, Harvard-educated Rhodes Scholar, former federal prosecutor and law professor, and now author of Lawyers, Liars, and the Art of Storytelling. He'll share the components of a great story, how to develop your story to get the results you want, and basic narrative techniques that everyone should know to help in day-to-day living. Keep up with show news on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and be sure and tune in every Monday at noon.
Hey, Dog Show fans. Does something stink in your home or car? Pure Air is a powerful odor eliminator that is the only natural food-grade product in its category. It works on bedding, kennels, litter boxes, urine, vomit, poop, even skunk spray. You know, all the fun smells our pets bring into our home. It's so non-toxic that you can literally eat it, a requirement for our home and our dogs. Spray Pure Air on anything you can put water on and let your nose watch the odor disappear. Ask for Pure Air in stores that specialize in natural, non-toxic products for home. Or visit dogradioshow.com for a link to their website. I'm Julie Forbes, your host of The Dog Show. Pure Air is the only odor eliminator you'll find in my home. You'll love it.
No shirt, no shoes, no problem. Come as you are. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And the girls respond to the call. I have a pool with shelter.
Who let the dogs out?
Welcome back to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes. Eric, do you know what year that song came out?
I will find out for you. It wasn't that long ago, but probably about 10 years ago.
Yeah,
I think now.
Seems like it.
Yeah.
Well, such a great interview. If you missed it, I was talking with Dr. Simon Gadbois, who's one of the featured presenters at this year's SPARKS Conference, Society for the Promotion of Applied Research in Canine Science. It's a great conference. You can participate online. You can watch it live streaming. You can go in person to Phoenix, Arizona. It's awesome. SparksInitiative.org is the website to find out more about it. So wanted to let you know about our show partners. Pure Air Odor Eliminator is on sale for the month of May at all PCC stores. So for those of you who live locally here in gorgeous Seattle, Pure Air is on sale at PCC. And then, of course, we love the Natural Pet Pantry, raw and cooked food for your dog or cat. You can find them online at naturalpetpantry.com. Jet City Animal Clinic is going to be hosting a Old Dogs New Tricks class, which is very exciting. I don't have the date of when that starts, but I believe it's in June. Old Dogs New Tricks at Jet City Animal Clinic. Going to be taught by my wife, Darcy Bolts, who's an excellent trainer and has done a lot of work in the service dog field. And she's really excited to teach this class as well. You can call Jet City Animal Clinic 206-329-0253 for more information.
Throwback, Who Let the Dogs Out? 2000 was when that came back.
Oh, wow.
If you can believe it.
Well, there you go. All right. Thanks for listening to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes.
Wish your dog didn't hate going to the vet. Wish you were welcomed by a team who cared. Jet City Animal Clinic is an enjoyable respite from the same old thing. Dr. Anderson and her team have created a full-service facility that combines veterinary expertise with a comfortable style. Jet City Animal Clinic is located in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood on 12th Avenue across from Seattle U. Bring your crazy questions, odd ideas, and alternative thinking. Jet City Animal Clinic will work with you to keep your furry family members healthy and happy. Traditionally educated with an open mind, call us at 206-329-0253 or email info@jetcityanimalclinic.com to make an appointment. Jet City Animal Clinic, a unique approach to the health care of your urban pet, a local family practice. JetCityAnimalClinic.com.